following is a Monday night thief lecture at Temple University given by Shrilavendra Swarup Das on October 31st, 1994.
According to Vedic literature, ghosts are they're there. The lots of different terms. One is most common one is Bhuta, which you can translate entity. Like here, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Pretan Bhuta Ganams Janye Yajante Tamasa Janaha. Those people who are in the mode of ignorance worship ghosts and spirits. But what we can do is give a fairly coherent account of, according to the Vedic idea, what ghosts actually are, how to avoid becoming one yourself, how to avoid... Another word for ghost is graha, grahan, which means one who seizes or possesses. All that is described. There's also another word for ghost in Sanskrit is ekapad, means they only have one leg. So if I can begin by describing where they come from, first of all, a ghost is a living entity like you and I. According to the Vedas, any time there is where there's a living being, there's first of all a center of consciousness, a jiva, individual spirit soul. And these spirit souls are animating various kinds of bodies. Some of us are in these human bodies. But the same kind of soul animates animal bodies, plant bodies. There are higher beings than human beings in the universe called devatas, demigods. And there are also diabolical beings that go by the name of yakshas, rakshasas, and also ghosts, things like that. But all of these varieties of living beings are just the same living soul. I mean, but have taken up residence in various sorts of bodies. And what the Vedas say is that the souls transmigrate through these bodies. They actually, in the Padma Purana, it says there's 8,400,000 types of bodies. So the living beings transmigrate. Now, what we are composed of is, first of all, a spirit soul, which is not made of matter. And then we have the two bodies, this gross body which you see, and then what's called in Sanskrit a sukshma sharira, or a subtle body. What we would call in the West the mind is really, according to the Vedas, the subtle material body. In the Bhagavad Gita, for example, Krishna gives a brief outline of what there is. And he describes matter as being made of eight elements: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. He said, these are my eight separated energies. So they actually go from gross or more perceptible to the senses to the less perceptible. Earth, water, fire, air, and then ether. But ether means space. You could describe it like this. I mean, that sounds a little old-fashioned. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. But if you just think of it as solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy and in space. It sounds a little more up to date, just terminological difference. So this is the gross matter. It's divided up into those kind of categories. And the space is the least perceptible to our senses, although it's not nothing. It's something. People would say in quantum mechanics you need many pages of equations to describe space, empty space, and it's supposed to be bent by gravity and so on. So there are properties to space. So that's gross. So we have this gross body. And then there's these other elements, manas, buddhi, and ahankara, which I'm translating here as mind, intelligence, and ahankara means my sense of self, false ego, actually. These are the subtle. These three make up the subtle body. We generally call it mind. But they're harder to perceive, just like space is much less tangible than, say, earth or water. So mind is even less experience, open to our experience. We know it's there, but it's hard to pin down exactly what it is. Philosophers actually doubt that such a thing exists and so on. But anyway, according to the Vedas, there is this subtle. It's just less perceptible, this subtle body. And then beyond that, then after you get... But this all belongs to the realm of matter. You know, we talk about the distinction between mind and matter, but according to the Vedas, mind is like another form of matter. That's what it is. It's like the subtle form of matter. And then there's the soul, ourselves. We ourselves are actually the soul. We are not the body. The first tenet of Vedic thinking is that we are spiritual entities, and we are not the body. But we've acquired this body of gross and subtle matter, the kind of inside body and the outside body. Now, it's important to understand this because Western thinking has tended to conflate the mind and the soul. Like the word psychic is sometimes used indiscriminately for the mind, for the soul. And when you see the mind-body problem discussed, soul and mind are not distinguished from each other. But the soul itself, the symptom of the presence of soul is consciousness. It's explained in the Bhagavad Gita that just as the sun gives off light and heat, so the soul gives off consciousness, and it illuminates the body with consciousness the way the sun lights up the world. So it's not that we can't experience the soul. The soul is the very condition for our having experiences whatsoever. And it means that the consciousness is not a material function. It's actually something that's spiritual. It's our capacity to undergo experiences, to be a subject and not merely an object. Like this book is an object in this world, and it's only made up of matter. My body is an object in this world made up of matter, but also I'm a subject. I have significance for myself. This book only has significance for others. It has no significance for itself. But I have significance for myself. That's because of the presence of the soul. Now, what happens to the living entity and the soul in the material world is described in the Bhagavad Gita that we change bodies. This is called transmigration of the soul or reincarnation. We change bodies. Krishna says just as you take off one set of clothes and put on a new set, so the soul at the time of death gives up an old worn out body and picks up a new one. According to our past deeds, our desires at the time of death and our good and evil deeds, we acquire a certain kind of body. All of us had long histories. We've actually gone up through all the various species of life and arrived at the human form of life, and now we are situated here. When at the time of death comes, the soul will leave the body, and there's a whole variety of destinations that await us, depending on our own desires, our history of good and bad deeds. Either we can take birth again in the material world. If we are free from all material attachments and have developed pure love of God, then we don't take another material birth. But if we still have various sorts of material desires, then we can go to heaven or to hell or stay here or take birth in the animal kingdom. It depends. If a person has spent their life acting like a dog and living like a dog, then they've got a snout, a muzzle waiting for them. You know, this is what happens because the transmigration is going on even now. Just like in this life, we've already changed bodies. The first body we were born with was something like about this big. And then we had a body about this big, and so on. It goes through enormous changes. We're the same person. We're the subject undergoing all these experiences, but we see that our body is changing, even now. So it's not so hard to understand that we can make a more thorough change at the time of death. So, what happens more precisely when transmigration takes place is the soul, together with the subtle body, takes another gross body. The subtle body, or the mind, is filled with all kinds of desires, material desires. And as long as we die with various sorts of material desires and have a different sort of mentality, then we carry the subtle body along with us and acquire another gross body that kind of fits the subtle body like a glove right on a hand. And so we want to live a certain way. What you have to see is all various forms of life are really expressions of desires of various sorts of people. So if one has a certain way that one wants to live, if one has become extraordinarily a carnivorous person and likes nothing better than to feel bones crunch between his teeth and hot blood run from his jaws, then you can take birth as a tiger. There's a very appropriate body which expresses that certain mentality. And in fact, if you start going around and looking at all the various species of life and understand when you see that face and that body that that's the expression of a certain mentality, you can understand why animals are called animals, actually. That's what they are. Even more horrendous are insects. So that's what happens, that body is the expression of a certain mentality and a desire to do certain things that make it very difficult for a human body but become easier in these appropriate sort of animal or insect or bodies and so on like that. Now, a ghost, what a ghost is a person who leaves the human body, the soul in the subtle body, but does not get another gross body. The normal course is a soul with a subtle body gets another gross body. But what happens when a ghost is produced is he does not get another gross body. The soul remains just with a subtle body and no gross body. Now, there are various reasons why this happens. One of them, according to the Vedas, the most typical cause of someone's becoming a ghost is someone who commits suicide. Because there, a person wants to destroy their own existence, so they try to destroy their body. So the desire is not to have a body, but you're still there, you're still alive, the subtle body is untouched by your poison or hangsman's noose or whatever means has been there. So the person again has to spend time in a ghostly form, this subtle body only. Or for various other sinful things. Usually someone has been very sinful and has a really bad history. Also, a person who dies in an intoxicated state has a very large tendency of becoming a ghost. All those people who die of drug overdoses, for example, can become ghosts. It's a little worries me a bit that the tendency in hospitals is to have people die while they're drugged to the gills. Not very good, actually. Actually, a person who's on a spiritual path should want to die in a very be very conscious. The time of death is very, very important. Socrates said a long time ago that a Plato, a philosopher, is a person who knows how to die. And one should actually know how to die and to die very consciously and know what is one is supposed to do. It's not good to miss your own death. Basically what they would like to do is drug you up to the gills so you don't know what's happening. This is not a good way to die at all. And as a general rule, because people are becoming more sinful, things like suicide and death by intoxication and so on, people dying into very, very disturbed conditions, ghosts are being produced. Now, there's a problem with being a ghost, and this is why they're known as grahan, or possessors, or grabbers. Is when a soul is in a ghost body or in just in the subtle body, all desires are there. It's not that you're in a spiritual state, but a person is full of all kinds of material desires, but unfortunately is not able to satisfy any of them because of lacking a gross body. Very attracted to doing various things in the material world, and also quite mobile. Ghosts are very, very fast because they're just in their mental bodies or subtle bodies, so they can zip around at incredible speeds and so on. So very, very fast, and can spy out on what's happening everywhere and so on like that. Can be quite powerful. But extremely frustrated because they cannot satisfy their desires. Sometimes a person becomes a ghost, remains extremely attached to some material situation, so they hang out in that place. One reason in India, for example, where they know about these things, that they cremate bodies, is the preservation of dead bodies tends to keep their former inhabitant hanging around. So that's why they're cremated like that. So there's business of preserving dead bodies in cemeteries and things like that. So anyway, the ghosts therefore would like to take possession of somebody else's body. So they exist, they're kind of like, they're subtle parasites. come around and they can latch on to somebody's subtle body and try to direct, control, take over, possess, and so on. And sometimes people are very vulnerable to ghostly possession, especially, again, the activities of taking a lot of intoxications and various things in the mode of ignorance. Some percentage of what is called mental illness is possession by ghosts. In the traditional Vedic system of medicine, which is called Ayurvedic medicine, the section that we would call psychiatry, psychiatry, the actual Sanskrit name is Bhuta Vidya. That is to say, the science of ghosts. Not all mental illness is due to this, but a good percentage of it is, in fact, people have become possessed. In fact, I happen to know one devotee in the Krishna Conscious Movement, Indian, from Orissa, who is, in fact, a ghostbuster. I'll tell you the story, actually. His name is Chiteshwara Das. He's a Brahmin from Orissa, and he became a devotee in the Krishna Conscious Movement. And he had learned from his own tradition how to get rid of ghosts. And he had performed like a sacrifice. Actually, one time I became quite ill having a hard time shaking it. And I go to generally get medical treatment from a friend of mine who's practices traditional Chinese medicine, acupuncture and herbs and things like that. So he was treating me. You know, when you go to one of these fellows, they do like Ayurvedic doctors. They diagnose by feeling pulses. And so he was treating me for this persistent complaint, and I was having a hard time. So this devotee, Chiteshwar, was coming into New York Temple, and a friend of mine said, "Well, why don't you have him check you out, see if maybe a ghost is, maybe you've been cursed or there's a ghost." Well, I'm a little skeptical, you know. So I go to see Chiteshwar, and I don't know, he has me write down my name and address on a piece of paper, and he puts it to his ear, and he goes through this whole rigmarole, and he tells me, yes, that there's a ghost. And somehow or other, sometime around 1979 or 80, this ghost got a hold of me and was causing me problems. Well, it's trouble. That's when I started to have problems. That was the year. So anyway, he was going to be doing a deghosting, and suggested I sit in on it. So the actual ghostbuster is not Chiteshwar, but Hanuman, a great devotee in the shape of a monkey, who's an incarnation of Vayu. Anyway, he does a sacrifice to Hanuman. And so we all gathered in the basement of the New York Temple. He was going to chase the ghosts out of the building. And anyway, at a certain point, he had all these wooden boxes, and he made a little fire and was chanting mantras and putting things in the fire. And he came around to me and some other people and had me exhale sharply three times into this box. He opened it up, and I could smell camphor in there and all kinds of other herbal things, you know. And I exhaled, slammed it shut. You know, and then he wrapped a string around the boxes, and then he went to the building and captured ghosts and wrapped strings around these boxes and put them all in the fire. Now he says these ghosts all get liberated, by the way, because what the only favor you can do to a ghost is really to set them up in another gross body. And he said by undergoing this process, they get liberated from their ghostly condition. They go on to. Anyway, that's what he said. I'm just telling the story as it happened. I really can't vouch for all the details of it. But so anyway, I began to feel better. I thought, well, yeah, sure. And so within a week, I went down to see my acupuncturist again. And I lay down on the table, and he felt my pulse. And he said to me, what the hell happened to you? So, anyway, that's what he... So I told him, you know, what happened. I began to think, well, anyway, that's a story. Ghost story. So ghosts, anyway, they can do this. They can cause either, you know, psychological problems or physical problems, as the case may be, because they can hang on as kind of parasites. In India, there's another thing that people do called Shraddha or Pinda. And this is particularly done as a matter of course. The oldest son is supposed to do it once a year for all his ancestors. They especially go to Gaya, but anywhere, they go to a temple and make an offering. Usually of prasadam is offered to the Lord, foodstuff offered to Vishnu, and then by mantras to the priest, to one's ancestors. This is done in case any of them have become ghosts. And by this process, it liberates them. I think I have some discussion of this. Let me see if I brought it with me, that part. Yeah, here it is. It talks about when the Shraddha ceremony is done. It's done to a predominating deity of Pitriloka called Aryama. It says here, he, Aryama, is somewhat of a demigod, and by satisfying him, one can help ghostly family members develop a gross body. Those who are very sinful and attached to their family, house, village, or country do not receive a gross body made of material elements, but remain in a subtle body composed of mind, ego, and intelligence. I just explained that part. Those who live in such subtle bodies are called ghosts. This ghostly position is very painful because a ghost has intelligence, mind, and ego and wants to enjoy material life. But because he doesn't have a gross material body, he can only create disturbances for want of material satisfaction. So that's the problem. Actually, ghosts gradually go crazy out of intense frustration. They're watching everything go on and they can't participate. And so they become quite mischievous sometimes, haunt people, become poltergeists, and so on, like that. So he says, it is the duty of a family member, especially the son, to offer oblations to the demigod Aryama or to Lord Vishnu. From time immemorial in India, the son of a dead man goes to Gaya, and at a Vishnu temple there offers oblations for the benefit of his ghostly father. It is not that everyone's father becomes a ghost, but the oblations of Pinda are offered at the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu, so that if a family member happens to become a ghost, he will be favored with a gross body. So that's what's done, as a matter of course, in India. Just in case anyone's ancestors happen to be in this awkward position. However, if one is habituated to taking the prasad of Lord Vishnu, there is no chance of his becoming a ghost or anything lower than a human being. That's one thing we have a remedy. Inoculate us against the possibility of taking ghostly bodies. Later on we have a feast of Krishna prasadam. And so it gives us some protection. It goes on in here and mentions ghosts. Uh, He's mentioned in connection with Lord Shiva. The name for Lord Shiva is Bhutanath, which means master of the ghosts. Lord Shiva is the demigod who's specifically in charge of the mode of ignorance. And so therefore, because ghosts and demons and so on like that are in the mode of ignorance, they are taken care of by Lord Shiva. You know, in the West, worship of ghosts and demons and so on is usually associated with Satan. Well, there's no such person in the Vedic pantheon. That is to say, some anti-god or counter-god. But many of the things that tend in the West to be associated with satanic things are you actually find associated with some one particular incident. It says that the yakshas, rakshasas are they're cannibals, ghosts and witches who are habituated to eating flesh transformed Lord Shiva's incarnation Rudra, Bhutanath, into a calf and milked out beverages made of blood and put them in a pot made of skulls. There are some types of living entities in the form of human beings whose living conditions and eatables are most abominable. Generally, they eat flesh and fermented blood, which is mentioned in this verse, is Shatajas Sadvam. The leaders of such degraded people are known as yakshas, rakshasas, bhutas, which is a ghost, pisachas, another name for the kind of ghost, are all in the mode of ignorance. They have been placed under the control of Rudra. Rudra is an expansion or incarnation of Shiva. Rudra is the incarnation of Lord Shiva and is in charge of the mode of ignorance in material nature. Another name of Lord Shiva is Bhutanath, meaning master of ghosts. So that's mentioned here. Again, Shiva is another instance which took place. This narrates how a great demon was conceived. And part of this conception was the parents, Kashyapa and Diti, had sexual relations at the wrong time. That time happened to be dusk, and among that was led to this conception of a very demonic being. So the sage Kashyapa is being importuned by his wife for sexual relations, and he's saying, you know, now's not a good time. He says like this: this particular time is most inauspicious because at this time the horrible looking ghosts and constant companions of the Lord of the Ghosts, that Shiva, are visible. He says, Lord Shiva, the king of the ghosts, sitting on the back of his bull carrier, travels at this time, accompanied by ghosts who follow him for their welfare. So Prabhupada says here in the commentary, Lord Shiva or Rudra is the king of the ghosts. Ghostly characters worship Lord Shiva to be guided gradually toward a path of self-realization. The Vedic idea is that Lord Shiva is one aspect of divinity that's got a special mission to the lower sorts of beings. In the West, they've kind of created this dualism where this kind of anti-god is there, who's actually hostile. But the Vedic idea is that there is such a being who takes care of these sort of demonic people. But actually, it's an aspect of divinity on a mission of mercy, and that's Lord Shiva. Mm-hmm.
So he says, ghosts are bereft of a physical body because of their grievous sinful acts, such as suicide. Lord Shiva, being very kind to the ghosts, sees that although they are condemned, they get physical bodies. So somehow or other he eventually works in some ways to also give them gross bodies again. He places them in the wombs of women who indulge in sexual intercourse regardless of the restrictions on time and circumstance. So sometimes ghostly people are also born. I mean, human beings, but they're of a very low nature. And this warning us that actually one should be very careful about this. So that was the thing. And then his Lord Shiva is described, a nice description here. Lord Shiva's body is reddish and he is unstained, but he is covered with ashes. His hair is dusty from the whirlwind dust of the burning crematorium. He is the younger brother of your husband, and he sees with his three eyes. Lord Shiva is not an ordinary living entity, nor is he in the category of Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is far more powerful than any living entity up to the standard of Brahma, yet he is not on an equal level with Vishnu. Since he is almost like Lord Vishnu, Shiva can see past, present, and future. One of his eyes is like the sun, another is like the moon, and his third eye, which is between his eyebrows, is like fire. He can generate fire from his middle eye. He does not live pompously in a nice house, etc., nor does he possess any material properties, although he is master of the material world. He lives mostly in the crematorium, where dead bodies are burnt, and the whirlwind dust of the crematorium is his bodily dress. So anyway, this is... goes on about Lord Shiva there. Although no one in the material world is equal or to or greater than Lord Shiva, and although his unimpeachable character is followed by great souls to dismantle the mass of nations, he nevertheless remains as if a devil, Disacha, to give salvation to all devotees of the Lord. So he's in charge of, it says here, devilish characters in the mode of ignorance, yet he's not affected by such association. So this is what who's merciful to the ghosts, and he tries to take care of them and gradually help them out. That's Lord Shiva. So although he's a great person, he's always surrounded by quite a motley crew of beings and ghosts and things like that, and one has to be a little bit careful and getting involved with that sort of element. So anyway, that's just a little bit about ghosts from the Vedic literature. Well, the main thing is one does not want to take birth as a ghost, and of course activities. Well, it depends. I mean, this future birth depends upon one's activities in this life. But it's very definitely a danger, especially the way people die nowadays is conducive to making people ghosts. The fact that people have developed excessive material attachments is also conducive. You look at some of these great people like Jimi Hendrix. And you understand that as a person that had to take birth as a, you know, as a remaining ghost, people dying of overdoses, cultural heroes like that, these are not good models to follow for our own well-being. Of course, our real effort should be through spiritual practices, through devotional service, become purified of material desires and to elevate ourselves from the mode of ignorance, the mode of passion, the mode of goodness, and then we can avoid taking taking birth as a ghost. And we can also avoid being ghostly haunted. Sometimes a little difficult in these days to avoid it. But generally, Prabhupada says when the best cure for ghosts is to chant the Hare Krishna mantra. That generally works pretty good. Well, Prabhupada mentioned, by the way, when he went to London, he was visited John Lennon's house, and John Lennon and Yoko Ono were complaining to him about a ghost there. And, he used to mention how that house was so full of ghosts that they were in some mansion that they had. So occasionally we de-ghost old buildings ourselves. We don't do the kind of thing that this Chiteshwar does, but generally if you go through with a party and chant Hare Krishna, burn incense and blow a conch shell, it tends to get rid of them too, because they're there. It's not a superstition. They cause a lot of trouble. I saw one once myself. The typical time that people encounter ghosts is just on the border between sleeping and waking. One time I was in that situation, and I woke up and I was very conscious of a ghost. I could even almost see a shape like smoke, sort of, and it was a woman. I couldn't see that it was a woman, but boy, it really felt like a woman. Was kind of staring down at me with not very nice ideas that I could see. Finally, I kind of was able to chant Hare Krishna, and she went away. But while I was there and she was staring at me, I felt paralyzed, like I couldn't move. And this is the typical way people describe an encounter with ghosts, just when you're, you know, half asleep, half awake, sort of, and you can feel their presence. Usually, it's a fact that male ghosts tend to bother women, and female ghosts tend to bother men. Prabhupada mentions that in a few places like that. And it's said if you talk about them, they're attracted. But anyway, this is the idea. Explain what it is. So at least you see from the Vedic perspective, there's a very clear idea of exactly what a ghost is, and how you get to be that way, how you can avoid... If you happen to end up a ghost, how you can be relieved. There's not much you can do for yourself under that circumstances, but Lord Shiva's merciful, or you have some descendant who offers pinda, you can be released, or you get a ghostbuster like Chiteshwar come and grab you. You can get yourself in another position, but the main idea is to avoid it altogether. That's the best thing to do. So anyway, any questions? Yeah.
There's such a thing as a repentant or helpful ghost.
Oh, yeah. There is. But if you want to find out about it, you have to do anything.
Anyway, sometimes it can happen. But for the most part, they are in a troubled state of... state of being, but there are beings who are like ghosts who can be helpful.
But I don't know. Haven't heard too much about them. The devotees are helpful. Yeah, Casper the friendly ghost, yeah. They are mostly not very helpful beings. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's like sitting in a huge banquet and having no mouth, no hands, no... and being starving to death. And it's tough. It's really tough. Yeah.
So, Prabhupada mentioned in that prevalent that committing suicide is sinful. So,
yeah.
Can you explain to me what most people want?
Why is it sinful?
Yeah.
Because your body belongs to God. And it's property. Just like killing another human being is sinful, so it's in killing yourself. It's not like you have a license to kill yourself. And because we have this body, and we say it's mine, but you know, did you make it? Did you earn the money to buy it at the store? It's a gift. You have it. It's given to you. It's given to us for a purpose, and we should use it for that purpose. So it's not right to hate other persons, and it's not right to hate yourself either. So a person who's got into that condition of self-loathing or self-hate, or self-antagonism, it's usually done so because of very, very bad conditions. So if that person commits suicide, then they become a ghost. Some circumstances are different, of course. Someone is suffering from some terminal illness. Then you don't need a Dr. Kevorkian, and you just fast. You don't take any food or any water. You leave your body shortly. That's a different thing. But for people who kill themselves because of self-hatred or despair or something like that, it doesn't help. People think, now, kill myself and all my problems are over. Your problems are just beginning. Believe me, this is not the solution. Definitely not the solution. Somebody else had, yeah?
Well, you said in India, they go and they offer food on the Vishnu to relieve the ghosts of their ancestors.
Yeah.
But how would they know if their ancestors were ghosts or not?
Well, just in case one is. You don't know for sure, but just in case that any ancestors got trapped in a ghostly existence, this will relieve them of that situation. So they do it. At our temple, people come and we do the same ceremony for them. Indian people, they're concerned somebody has died, they want to make sure. So they come and we offer prasadam and there's some ceremony done in the name of their recently departed relative. So it's a kind of insurance to help them out. That's what they do. I said there's a particular famous temple in India, Vishnu temple at Gaya, where this is particularly done. The Shraddha ceremony is done. But it can be done any temple. So we do that. That helps, yeah. Well, yeah. It says that anyone that becomes a devotee, many generations of this family get the chance of liberation. So that's very auspicious. Sure, there's the kind of ritualistic ceremonies that can be done, but if you just pray sincerely to somebody to help, sure, that can help. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, sure. Well, we're following our main scripture that we follow is Bhagavad Gita, and there Krishna is very clear that there's one supreme Lord who is Krishna, and everyone else is his expansion or creation. So the they're not all the same. They're not all on the same level. Krishna is described as Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan, Absolute Truth, the original person. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, you'll see Krishna says certain things like, there's no truth superior to me. All things are strung upon me as pearls upon a thread. Now, there are other people who are Hindus, and they have a different idea. I don't know where they get it from. It's certainly not from the Upanishads or from the Bhagavad Gita. There are places in the Vedas that recommend worship of various deities. If you want to pass your examinations, you worship Saraswati. If you want this, you worship that thing. If you want that, you worship these various demigods. But ultimately, Krishna discusses this in the Bhagavad Gita. He said, anyone who approaches any of these other gods for what they want, he said, I'm dwelling in their hearts as the super soul. I make their faith strong. And also, I dispose the devata that they're worshipping to grant their boons. So actually, it's all being done by me. So he says, whatever anyone offers to anyone else, any other god, a devata, a demigod, is actually meant for me, but it's offered without real understanding. You'll find these statements in the Bhagavad Gita. So we are following Bhagavad Gita. The Vedic literature is vast, difficult to understand. And the Bhagavad Gita is especially important because at that point that it was spoken, Krishna came and in a short amount of time does a survey of all the ancient Vedic literature and says in an authoritative way, this is what it actually means. There's so many disputes, and you know, you get, there's a saying from the Mahabharata, Nasavrisya Yatta Matam Nabinam. No one can be a great philosopher or a sage without having his own opinion. This is required. Mere agreement puts at the end of your career. So the more thinkers there are, the more opinions there are. So Krishna comes to say, I want to put it into all opinions. And he says, as far as what the Vedas are saying, he says, Vedaischa Sarva Ahameva Vedyaha. All the Vedas are really meant for finding out or knowing or understanding me. So that's why we particularly worship Krishna. And it's also explained that if you worship Krishna, it's not that you're neglecting anyone else. If I pour water on the root of a tree, it automatically nourishes the branches and the leaves and the twigs. Or if I take food and feed it to my stomach, then all the other parts of the body are satisfied. So if we worship Krishna, who is the root of all creation, then automatically all the devatas and all of the duties we have to any other beings are taken care of. So it's not that we disrespect Shiva or Indra, Chandra, Surya. These are all very powerful beings and they're agents of Krishna. But at the same time, we understand that they're not equal to Krishna, equal to God, or independent of God. And that's what the statements of the Bhagavad Gita very clearly say. And it's not, he says, those who worship the devatas go to the devatas. Those who worship the ghost and spirits take birth among such beings. And those who worship me come to me. Sometimes people say it doesn't matter what you worship, it all ends up at the same place. But Krishna says if you worship the devatas, you go to the devas. You worship the bhutas and the pretas, you go to them. And you worship me, you come to me. It's different. If I get on the train to Chestnut Hill, I will not end up in Ardmore. Yeah.
You keep speaking of the mode of ignorance. And, you know, this is something that I find myself very, very much concerned with, because it's sort of like getting the stain out of something that a clear...
The observation is many people can't see. That's a bit of a problem. The path of observation doesn't always... You have to know how to see, and you have to know what you're looking for. You have to have your eyes opened. Otherwise, you know, as they say, you know, you can point to the moon and they'll stare at your pointing finger. People won't see sometimes. So observation usually has to be guided by a certain amount of wisdom.
Well,
and then, that's all I want to say. That's all I want
to
say.
Okay.
Thank you. Want to serve up prasadam now?
Yeah.
We got a feast for those that are still here. Go ahead. Thank you very much.